Edifying on. How well we know the route by which the snatched away was taken, up or down, according as you choose to put it. For, like so much else here, the up and the down were confusing. For Joseph, probably for Abram too, the road to Egypt went down. But in Egypt it went up, that is, against the river, which flowed from the south, so that as you went southwards you went not down but up. It seemed like a deliberate confusion, like a game in which one turns a blindfold person two or three times round till his head whirls and he no longer knows hind from fore. And not only with direction, but also with time and the calendar, things were confusing down here below. It was in the 28th year of the reign of Pharaoh, and as we should say, in the middle of December. The people of Kempt said and wrote, the first month of the flood, called Tot, as Joseph learnt with pleasure, or Jehuti, as they call the moon-friendly ape. But nature and the calendar did not agree. The current year almost always conflicted with reality. Only at enormous distances of time did the New Year's Day of the calendar coincide with the natural one, when the dog star appeared again in the morning sky and the waters began to rise. In short, between the conception of a year and the seasons of nature, confusion reigned. Even practically there could be no sense in saying that they were now at the beginning of the flood season. The river had so abated as almost to be back in its old bed. The land had emerged, the sowing had been largely finished, the crops were up. Indeed, the journey of the Ishmaelites had been so leisurely that half a year had passed since Joseph, at the time of the summer solstice, had gone down to the pit. Somewhat dazed, then, as to time and space, he moved on in his stations. And which were they? We know precisely. The circumstances show us. For his guides, the Ishmaelites, who still gave themselves plenty of time, or rather, after their old wont, troubled about time not at all, only taking care that their slow progress kept more or less the right direction, went with him along the branch from Per Bastet, south, to the point where it flowed into the river at the apex of the triangle of the delta. And so they came to Golden On, lying at the apex, a most extraordinary city, the House of the Sun, the largest place which Joseph had ever seen. It seemed to his dazzled eyes to be built chiefly of gold. But thence they would some day reach Mempi, likewise called Menphe, time-honored, one-time royal city, whose dead did not need to take the water journey, as it lay already on the western bank. This they knew beforehand about Mempi, and from that point they meant to travel no farther by land, but to charter a boat and sail to Pharaoh's city, No-Amun. Thus the old man had planned, according to whose planning everything proceeded. And so they went on for the present, with halts for trade, along the bank of the Gior, here called Hari. The stream had gone brown in its bed, and lay in isolated pools on the fields, which were beginning to green as far on both sides between desert and desert as the fertile land extended. Where the bank was steep, men were drawing up water in leather bottles at well curbs, with a lump of clay at the other end of the sweep, to serve as balance. Drawing up the muddy, seminal fluid from the river, and pouring it into channels, that it might flow down into the ditches below, and prosper the corn against the coming of Pharaoh's scribes. For this was the Egyptian house of bondage so frowned upon by Jacob. The tax-gatherers were accompanied by Nubian lictors, carrying palm rods. The Ishmaelites did business among the laborers in the villages, trading their lamps and resin for necklaces, headrests, and the linen which the peasant women made out of field flax and turned over to the tax-gatherers. They talked with the people, and they saw the land of Egypt. Joseph saw it too, and breathed in its vital air as they took their trading way. It was strange enough. The customs, beliefs, and forms of the country were sharp-flavored like the taste of its spices. Yet we must not conclude that what he thus took in with his mind and senses was utterly foreign and unheard of to him. His fatherland, if we take in that sense the region of the Jordan, the mountains, and the mountainous country where he grew up, was a region of passage and transit. On the south, accordingly, it took character from Egyptian influence. On the east, from the Babylonian sphere. Pharaoh's campaigns had passed through and left behind garrisons, governors, and buildings. Joseph had seen Egyptians and the clothes they wore. The look of Egyptian temples was not strange to him. All in all, he was not only the child of his mountains, but the child of a larger territorial unit, that of the eastern Mediterranean, within which nothing could impress him as quite outlandish or absurd. Still more, he was a child of his age, that time now submerged in which he lived and moved, into which we have gone down to him as Ishtar went down to her son. Time and space worked together to create a unity and community in the physical and the mental world, so that probably the one actual novelty which Joseph perceived on his travels was just this, that he and his were not alone in the world, not quite unique, that much of the thinking and doing of the fathers, their outlook and their anxious speculation anent the nature of God, had not been altogether a peculiar personal advantage of theirs, but rather it was a property of the unifying time and space, aside, of course, from considerable differences in the amount of the blessing and their adroitness in the use of it. When, for instance, Abram had argued so long and ardently with Melchizedek about the degree of unity which subsisted between his own Adon and El Elyon, the Shechemite god of the League of Baal, their discussion had been quite typical of their world and time, as regards not only the problem they discussed, but also the importance they attached and the feeling they brought to its discussion. At the very time when Joseph came to Egypt, the priests of On, the city of Atum Re Horachte, the Sun Lord, had just made a pronouncement on the relation of their sacred bull, Merwer, to the dweller on the horizon, designating it a repeating birth, a formulation in which the idea of proximity and identity came more or less into its own. Wherefore also it occupied the thoughts of all Egypt, and even at court had made a lively impression. Everybody talked about it, great and small. The Ishmaelites could not exchange 5 deben of labdanum against a corresponding quantity of beer or a good bullock hide without hearing mentioned in the preliminaries to the bargain the capital new definition of the relation of Merwer to Atum Re, and being asked what the strangers thought of it. The questioner could reckon, if not on their agreement, at least on their interest. They came indeed from afar, but not from outside his unit of space, though, above all, it was the time they had in common which made them listen with a certain excitement to the new thing. On, then, the dwelling of the sun, the dwelling, that is, of him who in the morning is Kepper, at midday Re, and Atum in the evening, who opens his eyes and the light arises, who closes his eyes and darkness comes, of him who had named to Aset his daughter his name, On, in the land of Egypt, thousands of years the same, lay on our traveller's southward route. Over it glittered the gilded four-sided top of the enormous obelisk of highly polished granite which stood on the projecting foundation before the great temple of the sun. Here was the alabaster table of Re Horachte, covered with lotus-crowned wine-jugs, laden with cakes, dishes of honey, birds, and all sorts of vegetable produce. And here the treaders of the sanctuary, in stiffly starched kilts, panther skins on their backs with the tails dangling, were burning incense before that very bull, Merwer, the great bull, the repeating birth of the god, with a brazen neck just behind the lyre-shaped horns and powerful hanging testicles. This, at least, was a city such as Joseph had never seen, different not only from the cities of the rest of the world, but also from the other cities of Egypt. Its very temple, with the adjacent lofty-built ship of the sun, made of gilded bricks, was also entirely different in ground plan and appearance from other Egyptian temples. The whole city glittered and glistened with gold, like the sun, in such wise that all its citizens had permanently inflamed and weeping eyes, and strangers mostly drew hood or mantle over their heads against the glare. The roofs of its ring wall were gold. Golden rays quivered and darted everywhere from the tips of the phallic sun lances with which they were lined. All these golden symbols of the sun in the shape of beasts. All these lions, sphinxes, goats, bulls, eagles, falcons, and sparrowhawks. And it was not enough that even the poorest house, built of bricks made of Nile mud, bore a gilt symbol of the sun. A winged disk, a hooked wheel or wagon, an eye, an axe, or a scarab, or showed on its roof a golden ball or apple. For the dwelling houses, granaries, and buildings in the outlying villages of Greater On were the same. Each reflected the rays of the sun in some such emblem. A copper shield, a snaky spiral, a gilt beaker or shepherd's crook. For this was the domain of the sun and precinct of the blinking. A city to make one blink was On, the thousand-year-old. Yet not only an outward appearance, it was so in its inward kind and spirit as well. Age-old doctrinal wisdom was here at home, as the stranger perceived at once. It came in through his pores, one might say. But it was a doctrinal wisdom solely and simply concerning the measurement and structure of bodies conceived as in three-dimensional space, and the surfaces bounding them. Bounded by equal angles, meeting in sharp edges that came together at a point, which, although it existed, had no extension and occupied no space. And more mysteries of the kind. All this interest in abstract figure which prevailed at On, the sense for the theories of space, characterized this ancient city, and obviously had to do with its local cult, the worship of the day star. It betrayed itself even in the structure of the place. Situated just at the apex of the triangular region of the diverging river mouths, it formed, with its houses and streets, an equilateral triangle, whose tip, ideally, and also more or less in fact, coincided with the apex of the delta. And on this very spot there reared itself from a mammoth rhomboidal base the four-sided obelisk of flame-colored granite, covered with gold at the top, where its surfaces met in a point. Daily it kindled in the first gleam of the rising sun, and with its surrounding courtyards it formed the culmination of the temple precincts, which extended as far as the middle of the triangular city. The temple gate was hung with banners, and gave access to passages painted with the most delightful representations of the seasonal activities on the land and their fruits. In front of the gate was an open square planted with trees, and here the Ishmaelites spent nearly the whole day, for all the weak-eyed people of On came hither to do business, and strangers from other parts as well. The servants of the god came out to the market too, their eyes running with much gazing into the sun, with heads reflecting it on their shiny surfaces, and wearing only the short aboriginal kilt and priest's garland. They mixed with the people, and had nothing against conversing with such as would learn from their wisdom. It appeared, indeed, that they were kept here to that end, and only waited to be asked to testify for their venerable cult and the ancient learning which their temple possessed. Our old man, Joseph's master, availed himself freely of the unspoken but obvious willingness, and conversed at length with the sun-instructed teachers on the square. Joseph, at his side, listened too. The power of thinking on God, and the gift of giving laws to the faith, were, they said, hereditary in their order. They had possessed for ages a faculty of religious insight. They, or rather their forerunners in the service, had first divided up and measured time, and contrived the calendar. All which, as well as that fruitful understanding for abstract figure, was connected with the nature of the god at the opening of whose eye the day began. Up to that time, men had just lived on in blind timelessness, without measure or mark. But he who made the hours, from which then the days were born, had, through his wise men, opened the people's eyes, that they, that is to say their forebears, had discovered the sundial, went without saying. The tradition was not so clear with regard to the apparatus that measured the hours of the night, the water clock. But probably it was made through the circumstance that Sobuk, the crocodile-shaped water god from Ombo, like so many other objects of veneration, was, when one fixed it with one's watering eyes, nothing but Ray under another name, and in token bore the serpent and the disk. That sort of general survey, in fact, was the special line and learning of these shiny-pated priests. They were, by their own account, very strong at generalization, and at equating any and every regional and local protecting deity with Atum Re Horachte of On. A complex himself, and representing a constellation of originally single numina. To make out of many one, that was their preferred activity. Yes, according to them, there were at bottom only two great gods. One, the living, that was Hor in the Mount of Light, Atum Re, and one, the dead, Osiris, the Eye enthroned. But the Eye also was Atum Re, it was the disk of the sun, and so, to the penetrating mind, Usir was lord of the nightly bark into which, as everybody knew, Re mounted after his setting, to travel from west to east and to light the underworld. In other words, even these two great gods were at bottom one and the same. But if the shrewdness of such a general survey was admirable, not less so was the art these teachers displayed of avoiding offense, for in the midst of their assimilating activities, they took care to leave intact the actual multiplicity of the gods of Egypt. This they achieved by means of their science of the triangle. Were their hearers, asked the teachers of On, at all versed in the nature of this glorious symbol? To its width, they said, corresponded the deities, many-named and many-shaped, invoked of the people, served by the priests in all the cities of the lands. But above it rose and strove to a meeting the two legs of the beautiful figure, and the unique space which they bounded might be called the space of conspectus, distinguished by the fact that it narrowed as it went up, and the hypothetical bases drawn through it became shorter and shorter, until they had a very narrow extension, and finally none at all. For the legs met in a point, and this terminus and point of intersection, beneath which all the varying widths of the symbol remained equilateral, that was the lord of their temple. That was Atum Re. Thus the theory of the triangle, the beautiful figure of the conspectus. The priests of Atum plumed themselves no little on it. They had, they said, made a school with it. Conspectus and comparison were going on everywhere, but only in a clumsy and uninstructed way, not in the right spirit, without intelligence, crudely and by force. Amun, for instance, the rich in bulls at Thebes in Upper Egypt, had had himself made equal to Re by his prophets, and would now be called Amun Re in his shrine. All very well, but not in the sense of the triangle and reconciliation. Rather, in the sense that Amun had conquered Re, had consumed him and lived in him, as though Re, so to speak, had had to name him his name. That was a brutal misuse of the doctrine, a narrow-minded effrontery quite contrary to the meaning of the triangle. Atum Re, for his part, was not called the horizon-dweller for nothing. His horizon was wide and all-embracing, and all-embracing was the triangular field of his conspectus. Yes, he was world-wide, and world-friendly the nature of this ancient god. Long ago it had matured into blitheness and benevolence. He was ready, so said the shiny-pated priests, to find himself not alone in the changeful shapes which the people worshipped in the regions and the cities of Kempt. No, for he was also complacently inclined to come to terms of a far-reaching and general kind with the sun-gods of other peoples. How different from young Amun in Thebes, who lacked every speculative faculty, and whose horizon was in fact so narrow that he not only knew and realized nothing but the land of Egypt, but even here had no thought but to consume and incorporate, instead of giving free rein, in all of which, so to speak, he saw no farther than his own nose. But, said the blear-eyed ones, they would not dwell upon conflict with young Amun at Thebes. Conflict was not the nature or affair of their god, but rather complacence and harmony. He loved the stranger as himself, and thus they, his priests, delighted in converse with strangers, namely with the old man and his companions. Whatever gods they served, and whatever name they called them, they might without disloyalty and with good heart approach the alabaster table of Horachte and offer doves, bread, fruit, and flowers according to their power. One glance at the mild and smiling countenance of the fatherly head priest, as he sat on a golden chair at the foot of the great obelisk, a golden cap on his bald pate with its aureole of white hair, the white robe flowing wide about him, a winged sun's disk at his back, and presided with benignity over the offerings, a single such glance would convince the strangers that an offering to Atum Re they offered to their own domestic gods, to whom satisfaction was given within the triangle. The servants of the sun embraced and kissed the old man and his companions, including Joseph, one after the other, in the name of the fatherly great prophet. Then they turned to other visitors to the market to make further propaganda for Atum Re, lord of the far horizon. But the Ishmaelites departed, very pleasantly impressed, from On at the apex of the triangle, and bent their steps farther down, or up, into the land of Egypt.